Hello, I'm Peter Gilchrist.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton.
We are on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We'll be talking to historians, producers, and Scotland's finest to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're taking a look at the people that revolutionised Scotland's cuisine.
We'll be diving back into the 19th century and talking to today's food champions.
It's time to investigate our great Scots. Lindsay, do you want to introduce today's topic?
I would love to introduce today's topic. Thank you. Today, as part of our Great Scots series, we are going to be talking about another powerhouse of a woman in Scottish food. We're going to be talking about Kate or Catherine Cranston.
Mm.
Now, people who follow us on social media, who are probably the people listening to this podcast, will know that at the end of the month, or the end of last month? Yes. The end of last
month.
Where
are we? What year is this?
Oh, God. One sip of that wine.
In March 2025.
In March 20? Is it 20?
It is 2025, Lindsay.
Okay.
In March 2025, we held the Scottish Food Heritage Symposium. The second annual.
Yes, exactly. And we did it on the subject of tea. We held it at McIntosh at the Willow in partnership with the National Trust for Scotland. And it was a really sort of significant way of exploring the topic of tea because until we'd started looking at this, I had very little appreciation for the fact that tea rooms as a kind of cultural phenomenon really began in Glasgow.
Mm.
Very much down to the woman that we're going to be speaking about, Kate Cranston.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth noting that Kate Cranston's story gets intertwined and probably overshadowed by that of a famous Scottish man.
Right, okay.
And that man was Charles Rennie Mackintosh.
Okay.
Who was an artist and designer. And as we go through the episode, we'll talk about their relationship. But now I feel like certainly in Glasgow, where we're currently sitting, people know Mackintosh, right?
Yeah.
You know what his chairs look like. You might have a notebook with his designs on them. But you rarely hear the name Kate Cranston.
Yeah.
And actually, as we'll go on to discuss, Kate Cranston put Mackintosh on the map,
yeah,
really, and created a space for him to become the artist that is now synonymous with Glasgow.
Yeah.
So let's start at the beginning, as we always do. So her name was Catherine, but Kate is quite often the moniker that she went by. And she was born in 1849, so we have another wonderful Victorian.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a long life. She lived until 1934.
Jeez Louise.
I know. She was, and when you consider how much, as we'll discuss, how much of an industrious woman she was. That, yeah. Like, that was good going.
But she did, she grew up with privilege, we'll say. With financial privilege.
Financial privilege. She was definitely middle class. Interestingly enough, she grew up in a family that was very much plugged into the hospitality industry.
Right.
So she was born on George Square. Or she lived in George Square. That was her first place of residence, which kind of probably points to the kind of comfort that we're talking about mm-hmm. here. And
if you're going to be born in George Square in 2025, it's probably an accident and the ambulance was too late. It's not like it doesn't point to affluence.
You're shooing pigeons out of the way. But yeah, so she was the youngest of three children. Her dad was called George and he was a hotel keeper. So from the outset, hospitality is kind of baked into Kate's life, right?
Yeah.
Her mum's name, I love. Her mum's maiden name was Lace, and it was Grace Lace.
Oh, come on.
Can you imagine? Grace Lace.
My daughter, Grace Lace. No.
I like it. Although it is kind of giving drag queen.
Yeah, Grace Lace.
Anyhow, so she was born in 1849, middle of the 19th century, at this kind of really interesting point where restaurant culture is starting to develop. Hospitality is becoming more available to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
We have a move away from just beautiful dining happening in private houses, and instead it's happening in increasingly public spaces.
And I'm right in thinking, I know this might come slightly later down in her story, but the way that her family really monopolized hospitality was actually stationing themselves around train stations.
Exactly. Yes, it was incredibly well done in that, as I'll speak about later, when they began opening these kind of satellite tea rooms and houses, they put themselves in places not unlike Tunnocks, actually, when you think about it, tying it into that infrastructure of receiving parcels and letters. But they would have tea rooms at either train stations or locations that were tied to great exhibitions and exhibitions in Glasgow. So they were catering to infrastructure, basically, and these places that people were coming and going. And that was where you could connect with a Cranston service. But yeah, so her dad, George, before he became to keep hotels, he was a baker and a pastry maker. So we have this kind of confectionery running through, and there was multiple hotels that they had around George Square and the George Square area. They were, or rather, not multiple, but perhaps a succession. So it might, I don't know for sure whether it was the same property that just had different guises throughout its life or whether it was numerous buildings. But they were, originally it was called the Edinburgh and Glasgow. Then it was called the Crow, which I enjoy. And then the Crown. So this was happening. He was running those hotels when Kate was born, up until the kind of 1870s. And then they moved around Glasgow. One of the things that was really interesting at the symposium was learning how Kate herself and her family operated around. It was basically no corner of Glasgow that they didn't kind of touch with their business. So yeah, they then were based on Sucky Hall Street. And interestingly, by the sort of late 19th century, by about 1892, or, you know, 1880s, 1890s, the Cranston name was already being linked to tea and tea rooms in Glasgow. But initially, it wasn't actually Kate. So to begin with, Kate had an older brother. She was the youngest. She had two brothers and two half-brothers. But she had an older brother called Stuart. And he...
And we'll note there, she has two half-brothers because her mum passes away.
Yes.
When she's a child.
Yes. And then there's a second marriage.
Yes.
So Stuart was, as I said, older, only just older, born the year before Kate. And he really became a kind of tea connoisseur. And tea was his whole thing. And what he did before any kind of sniff of tea rooms came about was he was a tea dealer. He was importing tea to Glasgow. He was really, really passionate and kind of evocatively passionate about like good quality tea. This wasn't kind of stuff that earlier could have been adulterated with ash, or I've read records of Scottish tea very early on being bulked up with sheep dung. This was not the kind of thing.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Imagine the kind of like farmyard pong of your cup of tea. That's not what you would have wanted.
I know that Scottish tea drinkers tend to favour higher levels of malt just as part of our national palate.
Yeah.
I don't know how malt translates to bulked up with sheep dung.
No. I think that was pretty much a desperate time. But yes, so... In the 1870s, Stuart set up his business as a tea dealer. What he did was he opened a room at his holdings, and they were on Queen Street in Glasgow at the time. And he charged people to come and sample. If you wanted to come and sample the tea, you could come and do that for 2 pence a cup.
Right.
And if you wanted a cake or a bit of bread, you paid a bit extra. So that officially is the first sort of tea room that we have record of. And when we say that tea rooms were invented in Glasgow, it was Stuart Cranston and company that did it.
I want listeners to, when we're telling the story, to imagine it as a wonderfully financed Netflix series.
Yes, I'm picturing like the Gilded Age.
Yes, but like slightly gritty.
The Gilded Age in Glasgow.
The Glasgow Age. And like imagining, if you think about the bustle of the Victorian era and how heavy pedestrian streets would have been hit by thousands of people now commuting across Scotland, commuting to offices. Probably still commuting at this kind of era. People are still going home for lunch. And what the tea rooms begin to do, or what sampling teas begins to do, is it gives a middle of the day opportunity for businessmen to meet somewhere that's not a pub.
Exactly. And that point about it not being a pub is important around the Cranstons in particular, but also just around the larger social movements happening at this period. So what we have from the kind of middle of the 19th century onwards is the rise of temperance. And both Stuart Cranston and Kate abstained. And they weren't...
And what is temperance?
So temperance was the kind of quasi-religious, but not necessarily wholly religious, movement to try and stop people drinking alcohol. Mm-hmm. So it was, I mean, the kind of more religious belief was that it was sinful and all that kind of thing. But there was also a recognition that in Glasgow and in cities in Scotland in particular, there was a reliance on alcohol that was quite socially damaging.
Yeah.
So the temperance movement really sought to change that by creating alternative spaces, alternative means for people to socialize, but also, you know, come together in ways that didn't revolve around drinking.
Yeah. There's some really interesting, I think it's in the British Pathé archive, there's silent films that were shown in cinemas about the temperance movement.
Yeah.
And essentially it was like the man who drinks too much, who gets drunk and falls over in the street, makes a bit of an arse of himself, and then is kind of saved by a man of the cloth.
Yeah.
And it begins to attend temperance movement meetings, and the last images of him with his family and a warm embrace around the fire because
he's made good and everything's fine. I mean, it's really interesting, and it comes out in some Victorian cookbooks, not necessarily coded as temperance, but the idea, again, it's going back to what we've discussed previously, the angel of the house. There was this onus put on women to provide a nice home so that your husband wouldn't go out drinking. You know, there was the really sometimes unfortunate implication that if your husband goes out and drinks all your money away and is potentially abusive to you and your children, that's could be your fault because you're not supplying a good house.
Yeah.
And obviously, that's a very ineffectual strategy. Like, that's just not going to work. So what the temperance movement did was it kind of created a more solidified social movement, and tea rooms became a big part of that. Because if you weren't going to go to a pub, but you still wanted that kind of social aspect of coming together, or you wanted to go somewhere that wasn't your house for, you know, to chat to your friends or whatever, you'd go and drink tea instead of alcohol. So the fact that both the Cranstons were abstainers, I think, does tie into the reason why they're doing this.
Yeah.
In part. It's definitely not the whole, you know, they weren't holier than thou about it. They weren't, you know, bashing on about it. And actually,
they weren't apocryphal about it.
No, they weren't. And actually, I think that was quite clever, particularly on the part of Kate. So we have Stuart in the 1870s, and he's opened up his tea company. 1875, he has this room where he can come and sample a cup of tea and perhaps have a biscuit alongside it.
Mm.
And his sister, I mean, I assume they were chatting, right? I don't know anything about their actual relationship. Their businesses were very distinct, but Kate perhaps cottons on to this as a good business idea.
Yeah.
And she opened in 1878 what she called at the time Crown Tea Rooms. Interestingly, back to that point in temperance, the tea rooms were under a temperance hotel,
right,
which was a place that you could explicitly go to stay, no alcohol served.
Sounds dry as
dull.
Hell.
Well,
so dull.
But yeah, apparently at that point, she and her brother, they weren't working together, but she had support from the cousins of her dad. There was her cousins actually in Edinburgh were operating temperance hotels. So this is a whole family that's like got a monopoly on Scottish hospitality almost.
And the thing that I really enjoy is I believe I've read some kind of accounts that talks about the family really used that railway to jump to each other's businesses and I'm going to be here this morning, and then I got to jump on the train, and then I'm going to go off. And I'm
exactly.
Going to
so hotel. You've got your Queen Street location, you've got your Waverley station.
Yeah,
you're sorted.
Exactly.
Cranston's everywhere. So it's really interesting how they use that familial network. And what Kate did that was different from Stuart was hospitality and the kind of catering behind it was her focal point. Rather than he was very much a tea connoisseur, whereas she was all about the whole experience. So her first tea rooms are 1870s, and then she's opening another branch on Ingram Street in 1886. And then by this point in the 1880s, so Stuart continues to set up his own tea rooms. He has the Cranston's tea rooms appearing in the 1890s. There are all these sort of crossovers, but what was clear was that the businesses were distinct.
Mm.
So you had Cranston's tea rooms, which were Stuart's, and Miss Cranston's tea rooms, which were Kate's.
Although she, in the beginning, didn't use Miss or her first name.
No.
For set up her first tea room.
Yes.
For the reason that she didn't want it to appear to be a woman's business.
Exactly.
Because in the directory, women were listed third. Single women were listed third on directories. It was men, then married women, and then unmarried women.
Exactly. So the fact that she managed to, by this point in the 1880s, call her tea rooms Miss Cranston tea rooms was quite a sort of bold business decision. Yeah. And interestingly, she did actually marry, you know, she was a married woman in the 1890s, she gets married, but she keeps the Miss Cranston branding.
Yeah.
So by that point, it's
thoroughly modern.
Thoroughly modern. Now, this is a thing I love about Kate Cranston, and it's worth giving a shout out to the wonderful keynote that we had at our symposium, Perla Kinchin, who is the sort of foremost expert on Kate Cranston and the tea rooms. And she did this wonderful presentation about Kate. And in it, she has this wonderful sort of side-by-side image of Kate Cranston and Charles Rennie Mackintosh. And whilst Kate Cranston was thoroughly modern, she dressed in a way that was thoroughly not. So she, in the sort of 1890s, when she's kind of 1880s, 1890s, when she's at the peak of her kind of success with the tea rooms, is still dressing in the way that you would in the kind of 1850s, 60s. She's bustling around like this Victorian maiden in a kind of really...
Yeah, it's kind of like... I mean, back then you didn't really have as many like... throwback fashion moments.
No.
Everything was about modernity and dressing in vintage would have been a sign of poverty.
Exactly. You would have had the dress on from 3 years ago because that's all you couldn't have afforded new ones. And we get to this point where she is setting up her businesses. She has several tea rooms. And really it's in the 1890s where Kate's success, or what she becomes iconic for, really starts hitting home or settling in. And this is all to do with property acquisition.
Right. Okay.
Right. And one of the things I read was that she acquired like 3 rows of building on Buchanan Street, which may have been a wedding present. Can you imagine?
Wow.
Like from her husband. Oh, let's get married. Do you want the shit hottest property in Glasgow?
Do you know what I know neither of us will have done?
What?
Research who her husband was, really.
No.
Because we're not interested in the slightest.
No. He's not important.
I mean, now it would be good to know if he had the money to buy 3 rows of houses.
Well, and apparently they were. Apparently, according to some of Prilla's writing, that I know she's like spoken to the family, apparently they were incredibly close. So like they were a really good partnership. It wasn't just,
right, okay.
You know, I don't know anything about this guy, but... You know, he clearly...
He seems like a top bloke.
Yeah, he clearly was supportive. And by supportive, I mean put his money where his mouth is.
Yeah. But, and also, I imagine that if... I mean, I hope this isn't a reductive point. But as a woman in the Victorian era in business, she would have had to have been quite hard as a human being. She would have had to have taken a lot. She would have had to have expected a lot. Mm-hmm. She would have had to have pushed herself an enormous amount and dealt with a lot of social stigma, or just being in that era as a Victorian businesswoman.
Yeah.
You would have had to have contended with a lot, and to have found a man with character that will give her space enough to do that. And she doesn't stop having the tea rooms and retires and becomes a lady of the home. She becomes even more kind of adventurous in her business dealings and her expansion. And he allows her to then move to the next level of her business with his financial success.
It's quite amazing because having all those, I think you're absolutely right, like that kind of hard as nails attitude that you would have had to have was against all the kind of expectations of femininity that were happening at this moment in time, right? By the late 1800s, there is pushback. You're starting to have powerful women like Georgiana Hill. Agnes Marshall is a favorite of mine. Like the ice cream queen of London is doing the same. Funnily enough, also has a really lovely supportive husband who patents her machines for her because she couldn't get a patent at the time because she was a woman, but then steps back and lets her have the floor show.
See, like, why have I never heard of the ice cream queen of London? This is amazing.
She's great. We can talk about Agnes Marshall. Absolutely. But yeah, so she marries and things start getting better. And in 1894, she basically built, she's building buildings. She's not just buying things. She's like actually setting up real estate. And this is the point that it gets interesting from an art perspective, because she starts working. She's in this position of wealth and power where she's basically designing her own tea room. She has enough of a reputation to know that people are going to come. And so instead of sort of playing safe to the fashions of the day, she decides it might be quite fun to hire artists that no one's ever heard of. Mm. So she starts working, first of all, with George Walton, who was an interior decorator, and then Charles Rennie Mackintosh. And the interiors she designs, if any of the listeners have been to Mackintosh at the Willow, you'll know what I mean. Particularly for the time in this, in the 1890s, were so strange, right? It was a very new style of art. Mm-hmm. It was a very new way of doing things. Mackintosh, I mean, I'm not an art critic or an art historian at all, but it was almost more like what you would expect to see in the 1920s compared to the late 1890s.
It was like the precursors for Art Deco,
mm-hmm.
but also very like fluid in the way that Art Nouveau would become. It relies on a lot of like Orientalism and kind of the eroticism of the New World and things like that. And it is, when you look at it, when you look at like Rennie Mackintosh designs, and in fact, sometimes you see them in like Star Wars films and things.
Yeah.
Because like his chairs, his furniture, his pieces were so futuristic. What a terrible term. But when you consider that they were made in the 19th century.
Yeah. When you, when I imagine the Victorian era, I'm imagining opulence and kind of extravagance in design. And what Mackintosh did was strip everything back, but like imagine new shapes in a way that you might be tuned into if you were in the art world. But what was really sort of shockingly innovative about this was that Kate Cranston was giving these artists rein to do this in a public space where you would come and get a cup of tea.
Yeah.
So I read that apparently by 1901, so throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century, we would have had these exhibitions that happened in cities like London and Glasgow, where basically people who were traders or making technologies would come. It was like a big fair. You would showcase your wares. And the first one, the Great Exhibition, was in London in 1851. And that kind of marked a key point of technological like innovation. It was Britain trying to show that okay, we are at the top of the world in terms of innovative thought, innovations, technologies, etc. And Glasgow, as a second city of empire, had several of these exhibitions.
And it's not like an SEC Christmas fair, come and see some craft. It's the first place you might have seen electricity.
Exactly.
It will be the place where you've seen food you've never seen before. There are exhibitions to show what life is like in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
If you imagine that, you know, there's not really global travel for the working classes.
No.
If you're well off, you might head to Australia to recuperate in front of the ocean.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you might travel to India to the colonies.
Do a European tour or whatever it might have been. Yeah.
But for ordinary working people, mm-hmm. who might only take a trip to the road, somewhere rural near them, or to the beach or to whatever, this is like on their doorstep in the middle of the city, a gateway to both like the world and technology, things you have never seen. There'll be exhibitions of kitchens and new gadgets that you can use. There's things that you can buy.
Yeah.
People are selling their wares, all their new products, all their new Brown and Poulsen's new patent corn flour mix, and the molds that you can use to make. I mean, it is just like, and again, there are videos online where you can go and see some of the later exhibitions and they're fascinating even now.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like Disneyland for things and the world.
Yes.
I mean, I would love to go to one.
I would love to. If you could jump into Transport like a VR time travel to wander around.
Especially the free bits. And as you say, this wasn't just like a fair, like buildings were built for these, including Kate Cranston catered at least one, maybe more of them.
Hmm.
And there was a tea house specifically built for her to cater one of the great exhibitions on one of the bridges in Calvin Grove Park.
Yeah.
That I didn't realize until Perilla talked about it in her presentation. Now it sadly burnt down, but this entire building was erected for this one event so that Kate could have a tea room that was catering to the event. And by this point, apparently, if like you had innocuous design styles or, you know, something in a domestic setting that seemed to stand out in a weird way that you couldn't quite understand, it was called Kate Cranstonish.
Right. Okay.
So she's sort of, she's kind of not only this tea room hygienician, but she's like, she's a style. She's a lifestyle to be Kate Cranstonish.
Like an early adopter, a tastemaker, whatever you want to call it. She clearly has vision and she knows that it's not coming from her.
Yeah.
She has taste to see actually with all this wealth, she can make the world more beautiful. We don't really have patrons in the same way.
No.
At least in my understanding, and at least in the UK, we don't have patrons that find an artist and champion them.
And if anyone wants to be a patron of Scottish food heritage, get in touch. Get in touch.
We are for sale.
You can, yeah, absolutely. But no, I think you're absolutely right. And what Kate did, despite being this woman dressing in these mid-Victorian styles, who had quite a sort of, for all the world to see, quite a not conservative, but she was very traditional in how she presented. Yeah. And she was also like, she seemed like she wasn't a soft woman, right? No. So she was kind of like Florence Marion McNeil in the way that she was very passionate about creating opportunities for people. She, not just artists, but she often hired women to be her waitresses who were in difficult circumstances. She also, I mean, she worked these women really hard. She had, and apparently actually faced labor complaints at one point about the way she was treating her staff. But it was just kind of the time. And actually she gave women opportunities to move up in employment that just didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So she's entrepreneurial. She's providing opportunities. And despite that kind of hard as nails, old fashioned dresses, what she also does is gives Rennie McIntosh, who's an artist that no one's heard of, right?
Mm.
No one's heard of at this point. And this is sort of early 1900s. She basically gives him free reins on our building. She's like, this is a tea room, design it how you will. And he did. And him and his wife, I think, is it Margaret McDonald?
Yeah.
Who I love her art and I would love to, I mean, it's not food related, but another woman who kind of gets subsumed by her husband. But anyway, Rennie McIntosh and Margaret McDonald design these tea rooms in beautiful ways. So they do the Sucky Hall Street location, which is now McIntosh at the Willow.
Yeah.
But they do several other locations around Glasgow that are now just kind of lost.
Mm.
And apparently there are all these things in storage around the city, like beautiful benches and wall decorations. And it's just crazy to think about the amount of kind of opulence that was going on. But this was opulence that anyone could enjoy.
Now, I have in front of me a menu from McIntosh at the Willow from the early 1900s. And I'm wondering if maybe that might be a jump. Are we at the 1900s now?
Yes, we're in the 1900s.
Perfect. So, again, when you think about tea rooms, I think we initially perhaps think about things like high tea. We perhaps think about small sandwiches, scones, dainty cakes, and tea. But actually, the tea room here was quite... Or the tea rooms of the time were far more close to perhaps, or the menu was closer to a diner and what it was creating. So we do have, obviously, at the very top of the menu, we have plain or Russian tea.
Right.
Russian tea?
Mm.
It's tea without milk and normally with lemon.
Ah.
So it was a way of drinking.
Yeah, rather than
or the Russian style.
Yeah.
The actual Russian leaves. We then have hot chocolate, a pot of tea, and clear soup.
Oh, clear soup.
Is that
soup?
A consomme? I don't know.
I can imagine it was some kind of like clear broth, yeah.
Again, I can see why it's put next to tea and coffee.
Well, people drink Bovril out of mugs, don't they?
Yeah, and actually, I feel like there's a less of a line in Scotland between...
Yeah, like just having a nice mug of
beverages and liquid foods. Yeah. we then have things like large glass of buttermilk, aerated waters, large. I'm wondering if that's leading into...
It must have just been fizzy water.
Yeah, but then I'm wondering if maybe syrups and things do exist at this time.
Yeah, of course. And
you might have had early iron brew type things beginning to come through, flavoured mineral waters and things like that. Lemon or lime juice cordial.
Nice.
Now, this is actually quite key for a temperance mm-hmm. space. Lime cordial was like the drink of choice
yeah.
for the temperance movement.
And I kind of feel like it almost... See, if I'm in a pub and I'm not drinking, I'll have a soda water and lime.
Well, so lime cordial, mm-hmm. Rose's lime cordial, mm. by far the most popular, was invented in Edinburgh.
Yes, I think.
For the temperance movement.
Wow, okay.
I think it was 1860s, and I'll double check that. And it was a gentleman that worked in the Navy. And at the time, the way of preserving limes and mm-hmm. lime juice mm-hmm. was with alcohol.
Yep.
And then
rum.
Yes.
Famously, yeah.
We should have had a rum cordial.
God damn.
But then he realized if he used sugar, mm. then this cordial could be drank by a far greater number of people,
yeah.
including children, including people yeah. in the temperance movement, seniors and things. And so, yeah, it becomes one of these like monikers mm. for a temperance hospitality as Rose's lime cordial.
That's so interesting.
And then when we're coming on, we have bread or scone and butter. Cakes, French or plain.
Oh, ooh.
I'm assuming the French is just like dainty bites yeah. and the plain is just your
a
like,
big slab,
a big slab of ginger cake or something. We have a cheese board.
Wow.
Cheddar, Stilton or Gorgonzola.
Oh my goodness.
And it's only 1D.
Yep, 1 pence.
1 pence. Wow. To compare, malted milk with switched egg was 4D. Oh. 4 pence. So actually, relatively cheap, actually, when you're thinking about like a cheese plate was what? As much as...
Where in the menu is the malted milk with switched egg?
That is...
Is it a beverage or is it a food?
It's a beverage.
Yeah.
There's something called an egg flip, which
yeah, I was just about to say it sounds like an egg flip.
What's an egg flip?
So an egg flip is literally just like a tossed egg, like a whisked egg with a fork. Oh. Normally involving some kind of milk, and it was a big invalid recipe.
Right, okay.
Apparently, if you felt ill, nothing like a raw egg juice to make you feel better.
It does remind me, I remember Gaston singing about eating 4 dozen eggs a day.
Yeah, I feel like that was more of a protein bro thing, though.
Yeah, but it's always stuck with me.
Yeah.
As like a marker for how disgusting he was.
Yeah.
And anytime anyone tells me they eat raw eggs, I'm like, you're disgusting like Gaston.
Disgusting like Gaston. Like no one's disgusting like
Gaston. And then when we're coming into food here, I will say also have jam or marmalade. And so you can have toast with cheese, with gorgonzola, with grated cheddar, with jam or marmalade. And then we come into like, we have like sandwiches, pies, hot mutton pie.
Ooh.
We have scrambled eggs, Welsh rarebit. We have chipped potatoes. Or chip potatoes. Again, really big at the beginning, end of the Victorian era. It was initially something that was far more high class to have. The middle classes were having chipped potatoes. Mm-hmm. And then obviously at the onset of eateries and Italian fish and chip shops and things like that, it becomes definitely more for the working classes. On the other side of the menu, grilled steak.
Oh, wow.
We have cold roast lamb. Fried ham, tomato, eggs. So again, actually relatively
substantial
meals.
Yeah, this is a meal.
And we do have things like fish souffle, Wiltshire bacon, cold chicken and bacon. You know, we have a full menu here that mm-hmm. runs from everything from little French dainty cakes right through to a giant steak.
Exactly. And I think the diversity of the menu is very much tied to the fact that Kate is creating spaces that have multiple uses for multiple audiences. So in Macintosh at the Willow, for example, you have the billiard room. Now, billiard rooms were for men. And one of the things that is really interesting about tea rooms is that they create these social spaces for women. But it's important to remember that actually it wasn't just a space for women. It was a space where women could come and be, you know, and socialize. But it wasn't just for women. So they had spaces only for men. They did have spaces also only for women. But then they also had spaces where you could just come with whoever you were with. And really importantly, they had spaces, as you've just said, like some of the items on that menu were really quite cheap. That if you didn't have a huge amount of money, you could come and still socialize. And some of the, I can't remember if this is Kate's Tea Rooms or other ones of a similar time that, as soon as the Cranstons start doing this, other people do, right?
Yeah.
But you
most notably, Mr. Lyon.
Yes.
Came to the Great Exhibition,
mm-hmm.
visited a Kate Cranston tea room at the exhibition
mm-hmm.
and decided he was going to set up Lion's Tea Room.
Well,
which then became an industry, which then gave rise to Nigella Lawson, because she's the granddaughter of the Lion's Empire.
Wow. Gosh. But yeah, so you could come.
So all good things lead back to Kate Cranston and Nigella Lawson.
If it wasn't for Kate Cranston, we wouldn't have had Nigella Lawson. So there's your tagline.
There you go.
Can we get Nigella on the podcast? Oh,
I feel like it's some. I do. She follows me.
The degrees of separation grow ever smaller.
Increasingly smaller. Yeah. I do feel like she's posted my recipes a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be a fan.
Well, I
but
do.
Yeah. I have intense feelings for her.
I have this. There's a hilarious photo of me and Nigella where I was at one of her book signings once, and I'd asked her a question during it about like the act of writing recipes and stories and stuff. And then when she came to sign my book, she remembered who I was, and we continued this discussion. Stop. And like, I'm leaning over the table, grasping it with two hands. I look like I'm either about to like fight her or kiss her. And she's like leaning towards me. It's very funny. But yeah, we love you, Nigella.
I met her. I've had one conversation with her, which was at a book signing. And it was the first time I'd seen her,
mm-hmm.
was in the queue, had her book. You had to write your name on a post-it.
Yes.
And they would take it away and she would sign it. I'm in the queue, I'm talking to a friend, we're trying to come up with really funny things that we can say to her.
Mm-hmm.
And then out of nowhere, I hear, Peter.
No, it wasn't Peter, there, was it?
It was Nigella.
No.
I hadn't realized everyone else had gone and she had my post-it, was at my book, and was waiting for me to leave. So I turned around, aghast. Eyes open, silently, motionlessly walked towards her, staring at her, holding gaze. And she, like, looking back on it now, she was clearly waiting for me to say something.
Yeah.
And then she just kind of, in the middle of it, went, okay. And then, like, looked down at my book and started to sign it. And then the only thing I could think to say was, I hope you were expecting 100,000 homosexuals in your queue, because that's all you've got. Next time, could you think about doing some drinks? Because this would be a really great place to meet someone. She then starts to laugh. And so I have a picture of me with a blank expression, slightly shocked,
mm-hmm.
and her laughing while she's like signing up.
Was this in Edinburgh?
No, this one was in, because I think we were both at the same Nigella one.
Right.
So this one was in Glasgow.
Ah, okay. Anyway, back to Kate Cranston. Who I'm sure had the same kind of hold over Glasgow that Nigella has
had over us. Nice save for them.
So she's given Charles Rennie Mackintosh this chance. She's got these menus, these wonderful, vibrant menus where you can come in, whether you're spending lots of money on a steak and going to play billiards in the billiard room, or whether you are coming in for a cup of clear water. What was the clear broth? What was the
clear soup?
Clear soup. Whether you're coming in for clear soup and some toast, like this was a space that kind of almost erased class boundaries.
The reason that class has less of a hold over an establishment like this is because you're walking into art.
Exactly.
It is not like you're walking into a pub where everything's cheap. You're walking into a place which is a spectacular display of never before seen detail, art, a new movement. I mean, imagine walking into like some of these like kind of museum exhibitions where an entire space has been like changed or a new technology's on display. That's what it's like walking into one of these cafes. It is something to see.
Exactly. And there, and that was not, it wasn't like if you were down in the basic tea rooms, it was basic design versus being the billiards room or the Salon Deluxe. It was, there was different design bespoke for every area. So it didn't matter what place you were coming in to be in, how much money you were spending, you were getting that entire experience, which was really revolutionary because especially, I mean, by the this point, we're in the sort of, you know, early 1900s, but across the Victorian period and beyond, we loved to stratify experience and like keep nice things for rich people and not do you know, it was, you know, you had to stump up money to enjoy the finer things in life. And I feel like the business model she created kind of erased that by putting effort and detail into every little corner of the experience she created, regardless of who you were and how much you were spending.
Yeah.
aside from or in addition to the temperance movement as a kind of social underpinning of the tea rooms and the rise of tea rooms that Kate Cranston was very much spearheading at this point was the fact that this was a space where if you're a woman, you could go and socialize and feel quite like, you know, comfortable and that was fine. And that there weren't many spaces up until this point. So when she's opening the tea rooms, we're in the 1870s. And then we're right up into the sort of late 1910s. Until that point, you could be out and about as a woman. Of course you could. Like, this is the Victorian period. Women were very present. Women had been entrepreneurial in food for hundreds of years before this.
Yeah.
But an actual space where you could go as a woman on your own or to meet other women and feel comfortable and not feel like you're going to be harassed was quite rare.
I think there was also a lot of attitudes in the time towards it being quite inappropriate for you to be out without a chaperone.
Exactly. Especially if you were young or if you happened to be old. There are so many layers of interpretation on a woman's life that seeing a woman out and about on her own. We have this interesting thing in over the 19th century there, or over 19th and 20th century. Have you heard about the term flaneur?
No.
So the term flaneur is a young, mysterious gentleman who goes about the city on his own and he sees mysterious things and he sort of cuts about and basically has a nice, jolly time. Now, I don't know exactly when the term flaneuse was coined, because it's a French word, to have the female equivalent. But we're starting to see more women, especially like middle and upper class women or middle upper class women, writing about the experience of going out on their own.
I was going to say, I wonder if this is tied somewhat to literature.
Yeah.
Because I feel like there is like an emergence of like the mysterious woman.
Mysterious, and also like the plucky female character.
Yeah, it's Elizabeth Bennet. The one who, she has a muddy petticoat and she doesn't care.
Exactly, exactly. And by the time you're at Kate Cranston's time, you're at the end of the Victorian period, you've had sensation fiction, which was all about women and women's feelings in a way that was like, ooh, she's listen, turned on
listeners,
and it's okay.
Lindsay just rolled her shoulders when she said feelings.
Well, that's what it was. It was feelings. Body roll, as Chapel Row said.
Yeah.
Women were basically starting to be more outspoken about their physical feelings, their identities, their independence.
Yeah.
And what the tea rooms did was actually provide a space where if you were a woman, you could go on your own. You didn't have to worry so much about like those views of people looking at you and shaming you. But you could also go and like meet your pals and do the business of the day. Now, tea itself as a product, as something to consume, had been central to women socializing for like since the 17th century.
Yeah.
So bringing it back to Kate Cranston, she is taking tea from where it's been in private spaces for women for a couple hundred years into the public space. And she's creating experiences where you can go, you can pay for your tea. Now, there were taverns, there were pubs, there were coffee houses. They were all quite male dominated, where you would go and do your business. If you're a man, you'd meet and you'd have your business conversations. Mm-hmm. If you could be a woman in these spaces, but it might have been a bit difficult.
And you might have had to be accompanied with your husband as well.
Exactly. So it wasn't a place that you could safely kind of be on your own. Now, the tea rooms turned all that on its head because there was no underpinning of alcohol. They weren't segregated spaces, but they were places that were kind of created with this idea of delicacy in mind. These spaces are interesting not only because they provide... That's the thing. I shy away from saying it's like it's not just safe spaces for women. It was actually spaces where women could go and get their shit done.
Yeah.
And it's tied into far larger movements like the suffragist movement, where women would gather after protests, before protests. You know, it's very likely, and this is pure conjecture, but it's quite likely that Florence Mary McNeil might have been in a Cranston tea room at some point.
We do know after the symposium, I was having a wee read of some papers, and it talked about the moral hygiene societies.
Yeah.
And alluding to like women meeting, I thought, I bet Florence.
Yeah. I mean, moral hygiene.
In the Netflix series that we are going to have made.
Florence is going to be there.
Florence will wander
Kate's
in.
Kate's going to be there.
Yeah.
Thomas Tannock's going to walk in. It's going to be a thing.
It's going to be a thing. Let's take a break.
So as part of our episode on the wonderfully industrious Kate Cranston, we thought it would be wonderful to talk to Oliver Braid, who we've been working with to deliver the Tea Symposium and on various other projects. Oliver is the Visitor Services Manager for Education at McIntosh at the Willow. Thank you so much for joining us, Oliver. It's lovely to have you here.
Thanks, Lindsay. It's lovely to be here.
So, Oliver, I mean, I feel like now we go way back. I don't know how long we've actually been working together, but we had met through some food-related events and the sort of collaboration kind of naturally arose. You do some really wonderful learning programs through McIntosh at the Willow, and it just seemed like a really natural fit for us to have the symposium there. So, I mean, to my mind, it was a really lovely success. And it's just been a pleasure working with you. But I know how much you know, how passionately you speak about Kate and Charles Rennie McIntosh and the beautiful space at the Willow that you work in. So we just wanted to have a quick chat around that. So I think one of the things that I found really interesting about the symposium that I didn't really know as much of before the day was how much I learned about Kate, right? As the kind of head cornerstone of not just McIntosh at the Willow, but all the tea rooms. Now, in your experience, when people come to visit you at McIntosh at the Willow, do they know much about Kate?
So I work with a lot of women's groups as well. So Scottish Women's Institute, lots of women's integration groups, LGBT health and wellbeing groups. And there will be people there who are maybe, yeah, more interested in women's history or femme history.
Yeah.
And they will know more about Kate Cranston.
Yeah.
So I think it very much depends on like the time you've grown up in and the experiences that you've had as a person and whether that's made you maybe come away from the mainstream narratives and look at other narratives that have been more sidelined. I think one of the things I spoke with my colleague Isabella this morning, and she's been here right from the start, and we both agreed that either way, whether people know or not, when they first come here, because we're telling the story of Kate through the exhibition, through our tour guides, through my department, the learning department, and through information in the tea rooms, people generally come away much more interested in Kate's story. Yeah. Obviously, there's several specialist publications about her, mostly by Perilla Kinchin, but also, I mean, I spend quite a bit of time reading specialist tea history publications, and it's usual that she is mentioned there. So I would say, at the minute, she's a niche figure that is significant to niche people.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I think you're bang on, especially about that kind of like femme domestic history. You know, when I was doing my PhD as a historian of recipes and cooking, I was like, oh, I'm going to be writing about women all the time. But because I was looking at the 19th century, it was all these like key male figures who were these professional chefs, right? And they get all the glory. And I was like, how, why am I doing all this writing about men? I need to actually like push past that and look at the people, the women who are typically doing this work. And I think, you know, we've been doing our Great Scots episode and it's quite women heavy because a lot of food and cooking does revolve around women historically. That was our kind of like gendered labor was very much a thing. But at this point, Kate's at this really interesting point in time, like other women like Florence Marion McNeil, where she's sort of transforming that, or she's using that and using it in a different way where she's kind of making it part of her business model. So I think the work you guys do at the Willow is wonderful for kind of platforming her in that way as this kind of key figure who was clearly very famous in her time. Like I was reading something about strange art or odd domestic decor being described as Kate Cranstonish. So in Glasgow, she's very much like a figure that's known, but now the narrative shifted. So yeah, we're trying to redress that, but
I think she's such an interesting crux figure because, you know, she's born a Victorian and the Victorian period, even the aesthetic of the Victorians, this kind of much darker, gloomier spaces, feel, particularly for a Macintosh palette, very mask.
Yeah.
Even though we've got a queen on the throne for certain, like the first time in ages.
Yeah.
And then the Edwardian period, you know, we've got a man on the throne, but actually
things
the colours become much lighter, and what in Macintosh parlance would be considered sort of feminine aesthetic.
Yeah.
And then if you think about Kate's dress, you know, she's wearing a dress from the 1860s, but mixed with an Edwardian hat.
Mm-hmm.
So she's really conscious that she's straddling those two eras too.
Oh, no, she's. I would have loved to have met her. She seemed fascinating. What do you think she would have been like? Because the descriptions of her as a person seem like she was quite a force. Do you reckon she was, you know, what kind of person do you think she was?
I would say absolutely terrifying. It's difficult because there's not a lot of recordings of her personality, right?
Yeah.
People often refer to her as like, busy and businesslike. There's not a lot of discussion of like what her actual personal life is, but I think like some of the things that she did we could think about as nurturing. So one of the things we've been doing at the minute is developing this new actress-led live tour where you get to meet Kate Cranston. Our actress, she comes from a tradition of performing as a Victorian school teacher.
Okay.
So the way that she plays Kate is very strict. Mm-hmm. In our live tour, the experience is that you meet Kate and she's training you to become somebody who works in the tea rooms.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she's very firm.
Yeah,
she's got a very Victorian sensibility, which I think makes sense because, you know, the majority of her life was lived in that.
In that era. And and she's walking such a difficult line to walk, right? As this woman, you know, she does get married, but she stays Miss Cranston. She's the head of this empire. It's a difficult space to be a woman. And I think her contemporaries, people like Florence Mary McNeil or like Agnes Marshall operating out of London with her cooking schools and her ice cream empire, she's quite similar in that, like, you can't let too much personality show, but you need to let enough show that you become part of the selling point, which I think is really, must have been so difficult to do at that point in time.
Yeah, that's very true. Like Kate's personality is a branding thing, right?
Absolutely.
Like this mix of her kind of Victorian Edwardian vibe, this idea that she's always Miss Cranston rather than Mrs. Cochrane, even after she's married. Yeah, this is very true. It's a weird mix where like femininity is somehow exploited by that person or utilized by that person as a marketing strategy,
exactly.
But it also relies on other people's conception of what femininity is already.
Yeah, it's so tricky. And it's like, yeah, the angel of the house, but not.
yeah, absolutely.
My understanding from talking to you and visiting the Willow is that she was quite driven by social values in terms of how she kind of employed people and how she trained them. Can you say a wee bit about like the reasons that pushed her, how she employed women in particular and those kind of social values?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, with Kate and her background and the way that she ran her business, the scholarship and writing on it is sometimes quite limited and also sometimes quite varied.
Yeah.
So there's lots of different input, but not all of it is cited. And sometimes it's really difficult to tell where it's coming. So let's talk about some of the things, but kind of keep them loose.
Ouch.
Bearing in mind they might not all be perfectly cited because this is a PhD for someone really. So one of the things that I've always been taught and that we talk about on the tour is that she apparently invented one of the world's first workplace insurance schemes.
Okay.
So that the girls that worked for her, they had to put some of their money each week away. And then if they got ill, they could withdraw that money and be safe. Also kind of mentioned in that sentence is the idea of the girls that worked for her.
Yeah.
And in general, it does seem to have been young women that worked for her.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, we often give people this idea, and it's written about in different sources, this idea that they're often young women who have come from what she believed or what society at the time would have believed to have been difficult circumstances.
Right.
So single parents, orphans,
yeah.
Women who'd come out of the prison system,
mm-hmm.
and she would train them up to work. And then in some instances, particularly towards the end when she sold her businesses, business could have been handed over to an employee to take on.
Mm.
But also I think like several of the girls who did work for Kate Cranston went on to open their own tea rooms.
Their own teams, right, yeah.
And I think also, you know, we know that there's a flourishing of tea rooms and particularly kind of Glasgow style tea rooms in that kind of Edwardian period. And so whether she was having a direct influence or whether it was indirect, I think she was definitely creating this situation where women had a new route to take control of their lives. There's also kind of, there's this really nice, slightly weird example of her working with employees where if someone broke a plate or a glass or something, they had to pay for it out of their own wages.
Right.
But then if they didn't break anything else for 1 year, she would repay that money back to them. But again, that source is not that well cited.
Yeah.
But I think it does seem kind of in line with her general business. I think there's also a lot of debate around working hours and lunch breaks. Some people say that she was like really, really good to the girls and they all got fed. Every day they got like three meals, however long they worked, and that this was a really great place to work for young women, particularly women who were in certain circumstances that people would have viewed unfavorably at the time. Whereas other people would say that, although it's not uncommon at the time, that the girls would have to work 6 days a week for 13 hours each day and that they would only get a 10-minute break. But still, if you consider the other options that are available to people at the time, maybe this was still, you know, I'm talking about it from a 21st century perspective and it seems outrageous, but maybe at that time, if the choice was like
that or working in a factory or something,
it's actually still quite nice. And I think, but what's quite interesting is it does raise another question that I've seen written about the use of these young women that were in difficult, or I'm going to just say in difficult circumstances, but I don't believe they're difficult circumstances. These young women that were in difficult circumstances, is that possibly they were less likely to complain about the conditions.
That's a slightly less comfortable way of looking at it, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think it's good to think about both sides, right? Like I think we can't just raise up another historical character like we did with McIntosh.
No.
And let's be really open to the fact that people have like diverse facets of personality. And I guess, right, we should celebrate the fact that in Kate's work, because I feel like I don't want to come away with this feeling like we really bashed Kate Cranston.
No, of course.
There's so much good about her. That actually, when she trains girls, they do go on to rise above that station. She is kind of helping people to emancipate themselves to a degree. So they're.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a double-edged coin or double-sided coin, double-edged sword. I'm mixing my metaphors here.
Yeah.
but there are good and bad sides to both. And I think ultimately good sides, right? In this work, people were being trained in an environment that comparatively was probably quite a pleasant place to work, was quite a safe place to work. You know, you're in the tea rooms as well. You're not being exposed to drunken people in taverns or pubs. There's like that kind of layer to this as well. So I think, I think we can come away from this feeling good about Kate.
Yeah, I think it would be really interesting to sit and have a cup of tea with her.
Mm-hmm.
And like we said before, there's not that much about her actual personality.
Yeah, exactly. Like what kind of person she was.
Yeah, I think it'd be really interesting to know a bit more about Isabella, and I discussed this morning her relationship to social equality. You know, is she interested beyond herself and her business? We know that tea rooms in general have this element where they supported or provided space for suffragettes to maybe meet and discuss. There's no information really about Kate's relation to suffrage. I'd love to know about what her
like
personal opinion is, but probably as a business person, she knows that
Yeah.
The opinion could affect her business, but it'd be interesting to know on a personal level, what is her real relationship to suffrage and other politics around femininity? We would also love to know a bit more about one of the stories that we get asked a lot at the minute in the tea rooms is the place of people with global majority heritage or people of colour, and like what their place in the tea room was. Actually at a kind of level of like whether people were coming into the tea rooms, and also kind of what I would love to know about what Kate's awareness of or feeling was about the impact of the tea industry on global majority people who were working in that environment and kind of feeding into her success.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think a lot of the talks that we had at the symposium were touching upon those sort of darker histories, and it does underscore a lot of this in all of this in the Scottish context, and it's it would be interesting to know whether that was a moral conflict or whether that was just so accepted kind of as it is today that it didn't really come across as something to worry about. Now, just before we finish, Oliver, thank you so much for joining us, but we do when we have guests on the podcast, we tend to ask them some quick fire questions around your opinions on Scottish food, well, kind of your personal preferences. So I'm just going to fire through them.
Great.
If you're ordering a morning roll, what kind of roll do you want and what filling do you go for?
So Lindsay, I always order two morning rolls.
Oh wow, love that.
I have one soft and one crispy to get the balance.
Yeah,
because in England we don't get that option, you know. We don't look after ourselves that well, we just take what we give. So I enjoy having the choice. So I have a soft and a crispy. And oh gosh, this is so naughty. I always have a double.
Yeah.
Or a doubler, as I think we might call it in Scotland. and that is normally links, because I really enjoy saying the word links. Because again, in England, you know, it's only links. There's no square option. Sometimes I go through a square face, but normally it's links and bacon. If it's a Saturday or a Sunday, depending how emotional I feel, I might go tripler and also have an egg or a scone put on it.
Love it.
Yeah. I'm a breakfast monster.
Oh, nothing better. Okay. With your bread, plain or pan?
Well, again,
not really a choice.
Really a choice in England, but I was really into when I first moved here, I got introduced to like pan and I was really into it. But I have to admit, and this is shameful around working where I do, but I have had a physical fear of sandwiches since I've been about 4 years old. So I never eat sandwiches. The only bread that I eat is toast. And then it's just like, just a sort of gorgeous, like a bloomer, like a pre-sliced bloomer or something. Yes.
Can't believe that you work in an afternoon tea room and you are scared of sandwiches.
I quiver every time I see sandwiches go out. When we were serving them at the symposium, I was, I mean, they're very good sandwiches, but it's when I was a kid, there was a boy who used to have tomato ketchup sandwiches in my nursery. And I think it just really freaked me out.
Funnily enough, we're not the only person I have heard say that they have a phobia of specifically tomato ketchup sandwiches. So there's something about that that's like scarring people.
That's good to know.
Yeah. Okay. Do you have your porridge if you eat porridge?
Again, porridge has been like a real new thing for me. Mm. I used to have this fantasy in my mind that porridge didn't fill me up. And I just always felt like, God, it's such a mess to make. I can't be bothered to wash the pot for like a week after. It just sits in my sink all wet. And then it doesn't actually fill me up and it doesn't really taste like anything. But so nowadays I'm into porridge, but it's a microwavable affair for me. Normally a sort of apple and blueberry flavour with some lovely fresh Scottish raspberries mixed into it.
Delicious. Tunnocks. Do you prefer a log, a caramel log, a caramel wafer or a tea cake?
Oh, really great question. My ex-boyfriend used to live in London and I would have to send him Tunnocks items because they couldn't get them there. And through that, so I'd always had the normal log, and then I discovered is the one that's covered in toasted coconut, is that the caramel?
That's caramel log, yes.
Oh my gosh, I'm just so addicted to them. I can't really buy them anymore because I need to eat all four of them. Oh, yeah, delicious. Caramel log, but I do also love smashing up a tea cake, and we're making tea cakes later in the year with families, so I'm really excited about seeing that process.
Oh, that's very fun. Yeah, I recently got on the caramel log train too, and they are really good.
It's amazing. I've never had anything like it.
I know.
Yum.
A thing unto itself. Okay, if you were going to put a family recipe into a cookbook, what would it be?
A family recipe?
Yeah, something that you associate with family or home, whatever that might mean to you.
Okay, so about, gosh, about 18 years ago or something, I lived in Liverpool and I lived with one of my friends, and we used to really like making, it's quite controversial, although it has some precedent in Scotland, a spaghetti bolognese pie, something I invented myself, I think.
Wow.
It's like a short crust pastry pie. And then you make a spaghetti bolognese and fill the pie with spaghetti and bolognese sauce and mince. And then you put loads of different types of cheeses over it, like Stilton and Parmesan. Oh. And then you bake it. And so the top of the pie goes really crusty, like the cheese and the spaghetti. I was very poor when I lived in Liverpool. And I think it's definitely like a real carby thing.
So good, though. And you're right.
But let me contribute a spaghetti pie.
Spaghetti pie, I love that. I mean, we have obviously macaroni pies, and then I've had lasagna pies, which seems to be a similar vibe. But yeah, I'm all for a spaghetti pie. That sounds amazing. Okay, what ingredient in your kitchen or wherever you prepare your food do you tend to go for? Like, what's your favorite ingredient to reach for when you're cooking?
Oh, so just absolutely love turmeric.
Oh.
Like, I love it for cooking savouries, but I also just absolutely love it in teas. I love kind of getting it all over me and being a bit stained by it. Yeah, I just think there's something really beautiful about it in every single setting. It's just such a lovely warm colour. Mm. Yeah, let me select turmeric.
Turmeric, I love that. I recently redid my kitchen, and I live in a tenement, so I've got like one of those old nooks, you know, like where the bed used to be, and it's painted this like turmeric mustardy orange. And it's so, every time I go in, it just makes me happy.
Yeah,
okay, do you have a favorite Scottish word?
Oh, do I have a favorite Scottish word? Oh my gosh. I like gleek it.
Gleek
is that
it,
right? Am I saying it right? Gleek,
yeah,
gleek it. Oh, gosh, everyone in Scotland's going to hate me for trying to do it. I apologise. I've lived here 17 years and I still can't do it.
No, I think gleek is good.
And I like it because I think quite a lot of the time I walk around with a gleek it expression on my face. Recently, I was in the West End and an older woman pushed me into the road because I was just kind of drifting through. But it's, you know, people think that it's maybe like silly or a bit daft as a face, but actually I think it's really calming and relaxing to have that expression, right?
Just
you're just giving your eyes a rest,
vibing around being gleek it. Yeah, love that. Okay, and if you remember this, if you were ever sort of in the kitchen cooking when you were younger, do you remember being given like the first job you were maybe given around food?
So my mom was a primary school teacher, so I think she really understood quite well kind of working with kids and doing these kind of activities from a young age. We used to do a lot of cakes, obviously, and probably mixing batter, but also consuming the remnants of the bowl.
I was going to say, yeah, did you get to lick
roll.
The spoon? Yeah, I used to love that.
Yeah.
Sometimes people are like, oh, what about the raw eggs? I don't think my mum really cared because it was just like, yeah.
It's totally fine, isn't it? If you're not pregnant.
Delicious,
yeah.
Delicious. Well, thank you so much, Oliver, for taking the time to chat to me about the tea rooms and about Kate and about all the sort of very interesting political things that go into both of those topics. It's been really lovely to chat to you. And thank you, for joining us on the podcast. So we've heard about the life of Kate Cranston as a remarkable entrepreneur.
Mm.
She was one of the best known people in Glasgow at the time. She was a Glasgow celebrity. People not only knew who she was, but they satirized her. And I think I love that as a historian. If you're being laughed at in like the press, it's because you're a big deal, right?
Right.
So she's this remarkable woman. Her story kind of ends on quite a sad note. Her husband died in 1917, and she really didn't deal with it very well at all because they'd been really, yeah, really close. And she ends up sort of moving out of the house that they had co-owned that McIntosh designed, because apparently it wasn't enough. Like, he designed their actual home. This was how invested she was in him as an artist. But she moves and she ends up kind of perishing and getting dementia, or being, well, what we would probably now understand as dementia, which was then called senile decay. So she has quite a sad fizzle of a life for this woman that she was. And I think part of what we're trying to talk about today is how Kate Cranston's legacy should be as much, if not more so, a part of Glasgow's history and current understanding of itself as Charles Rennie Mackintosh.
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't have been Charles Rennie Mackintosh if she hadn't let him do his thing in her tea rooms.
And then we're kind of always asking ourselves, and when we're talking about the great Scots, mm-hmm, what would have happened if they hadn't existed?
I think Kate Cranston is such an interesting example of that, because not only would tea culture not have been what it is, which is inherently part of, you know, Scottish identity still, despite, as we went into at the symposium, it's kind of global origins, but Glasgow itself would not look the same. Charles Rennie Mackintosh would not be the artist he was.
And I suppose we hope that someone at some point would have cottoned on to tea rooms, mm-hmm, and coffee houses.
Yeah.
But coffee houses and tea rooms around the world can trace their lineage back to one day when Catherine Cranston, working in her brother's tea shop, helping out by pouring water into tea blends and getting sandwiches and biscuits for the businessmen, thinking, there's a business here.
Yeah, there's an idea here.
There's an idea here. And that, through the ages, through the centuries, from Central Perk to Russian tea rooms to every coffee house that you walk into to today, if you get up and go out by yourself as a woman, maybe especially, to go into a coffee shop to buy yourself your flat white, I assume, your latte, that you can in your head give a little thanks to Catherine Cranston. This episode of the Scottish Root History Podcast was hosted by Dr. Lindsay Middleton and Peter Gilchrist. This episode was produced by Tenement Kitchen.